16th, I, Derek Wolf, who you're listening to right now, the editorial page editor of the Michigan Daily, sat down for an interview with Professor Brian Coppola. He is the Arthur F. Thurnau Professor of Chemistry, as well as the Associate Chair for Educational Development and Practice. But perhaps he is best known at the university for teaching Chem 210, or Orgo 1. And I think it's fair to say, while I have no study to prove this, that Professor Coppola ranks in many students' top five lists of favorite professors. The intention of the interview was to discuss teaching philosophies in science education, but it turned into something much more significant. While the interview was a little long, around 20 minutes or so, and the audio is not the best since I recorded it on an iPhone, I'm going to try to not do that again in the future, I believe it is worth your time. So please, enjoy and let me know what you think.
So, I guess why I wanted to talk to you is I took Chem 230 last semester, and I had this realization, science is not, it's not about the science. How would you respond to that? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Sure, I agree. So if I think about it sort of in the short delivery sort of mode, you know, I think all the facts and the concepts and all that kind of stuff, to me, is a vehicle. And I think that's true in all the disciplines, actually, right? The factual subject matter comes, goes, changes, has a lifetime of, you know, 30 days in your head and so forth. And I think what's really important are what some people call the enduring messages, mm-hmm. the enduring skills or the enduring lessons. And I see those as falling into three categories. You can agree or not. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter. I see them falling into three categories. Yeah. You know, I think conceptual mastery is a real thing, but conceptual mastery isn't a bunch of stuff. Conceptual mastery is feeling confident that you can see new and unfamiliar information and not run from the room screaming because you've never seen it before. You can go, okay, I can either handle this or I can look some stuff up and handle it, right? I'm not intimidated by new stuff. And I'd argue that's not unimportant. I'm listing it first. Because whatever profession you're in, you hope that you're in a dynamic profession. You hope that there's change and new things that are known. And I think the thing that comes with that that's underappreciated is that we have to be in the business of changing our minds. It isn't just, you know, fixed. Dealing with uncertainty is really key. You aren't at the state of the art of anything unless you're uncertain. Because if you were certain, you wouldn't be there, right? You'd be off roaming around. You're not at any place interesting unless there's the debate associated with it. Really good people of good conscience can disagree. And science and history and philosophy and psychology, the edges of everything involve people's disagreement as they're working it out. So, you know, if you're a person that hasn't learned how to change your mind about stuff, that's a real problem because otherwise you think you're right about everything.
Right.
Right? And that's really problematic. So, you know, the conceptual mastery, I think, is a very rich topic. And the second one, I think, is really improving one's ability to learn. You hope that continues to grow and evolve and not necessarily have to be tied to classes. But I think classes in different subject areas present a really nice opportunity for people to learn in a different area, which could require different ways of learning and sort of enhancing and broadening and diversifying your skills. And we know from a long time ago, we did interviews with students, had to be the early 90s. You're like a baby.
I may not have been born yet.
Maybe not. Students in Chem 210 who had progressively increased on every examination, and students in 210 who had progressively decreased. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to understand. I mean, there wasn't huge groups, but there were groups of both who on an absolute sense had gone up on an absolute sense. And it's the students who went down who were really the most interesting. Because what they were was stubborn. This is the way I learn. This is how I've been rewarded. I don't want to change. I don't need to change. The problem is everywhere else.
Yeah, it's not...
Right? It's not me. The problem is everywhere else. And there was that kind of reticence to change, which told us what we knew. We do think that organic chemistry and chemistry 210 in particular, as we've structured at the University of Michigan, does have a lot of very unique challenges associated with it compared to other places. But we think it's all positive if people will just come along and play the game. And the students, the counterpoint is the students who really inclined through the course of the semester took the first exam and said, well, crap, I'm not doing as well as I wanted to. I need to change something. Well, what'd you need to change to? Well, you told us a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
I'll go do that, and I'll go do that. And they had this kind of personal responsibility for it and said, I need to do something different to respond to this. So so that kind of, you know, that sort of conceptual mastery of learning how to learn. The third one of three to me is really the big bucket. Some people call it learning-related attitudes, values, and beliefs. These, I think, are the things that one also carries away. And they are the things that, you know, the concepts and all that kind of stuff pretty much appear on the syllabus, in the book, and on the exams. The learning how to learn piece, like the incliners and the decliners story, I think you're going to do it or you're not going to do it, and it's probably going to pay off. The learning-related attitudes, values, and beliefs, what are those kinds of things? Those are the kind of things that never appear on the syllabus, but they're there. For example, scientific skepticism. You can't look at the Chem 210 syllabus and say, oh, on day 12, they covered skepticism. Yeah. Doesn't work that way, right? A person who is a chemist carries scientific skepticism with him or herself every day. So if I go into class and I'm talking honestly about science, that disposition of science, something that comes along with science that is just embedded in the way I think, is going to come through with it. And issues of ambiguity and uncertainty. And, you know, if I can get, after the first month, a bunch of students in room 1800 yelling out, I don't know, I need to know the results of the experiment, and I've achieved something there, because they've moved from the idea of science as a fixed set of things to a dynamic, what do the data say, what do the results say, what's the observation,
why should I believe what you're telling me?
Exactly right.
So, clearly you've thought about this, maybe, unless you just invented this
morning.
A little bit, right? Yeah. How has this changed over the years? How have you gotten to this point?
It certainly has evolved, like everything does. You know, you start off with a premise, you try things out, just like the students, something doesn't work very well. It's really like trying out material, in a sense. I've been fortunate in that my career has been focused on thinking about the education parts of chemistry, that interface between chemistry and education. So it's really what I'm supposed to do, right? That's the area I read in, that's the area I write in. And if one looks back, if you could look back over, you know, 15 years worth of talks or PowerPoints and so forth, you can see that the ideas evolve. You know, one of the reasons that in this profession we run around and go to other universities and give talks, you know, other people want to learn what you're doing. But I'll tell you, the biggest benefit is to the speaker, because you're trying out material. You're seeing how it sounds. You're getting the feedback from people. And then you go, oh, yeah, that was a good point. I hadn't thought about that. And then it moves forward.
Have you ever given a lecture for Chem 210, or just even when you're speaking, and you're just like, wow, that was terrible?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, in Chem 210, I remind you of, something. It ought to cause you to have jitters. But to Chapter 2, this kind of hand-waving introduction to quantum mechanics and bonding and orbitals and all this kind of stuff. It's just not a topic that's done well. The rate of change of me thinking about that topic has a half-life of about 3 minutes.
Yeah.
I'm always changing it. And the presentation is always bad.
Yeah.
You know, and then it maybe gets a little better here and worse there and so forth. So yeah, absolutely. I've put my, and in public talks, I've put my foot in it more than once. It's okay.
Yeah.
It happens. You know, and the thing is that, you know, you finally get experience enough that you're just like, oh, you just turn around. You don't turn around and go, oh crap, and crawl under a door. You go, God, that's really awesome. Thank you. You're absolutely right. I'm absolutely wrong. Let's talk about that. That's okay, right?
So you're constantly thinking of ways to.
Always. And we have the organic chemists at the University of Michigan are a great group of people. because it is a conversation we have amongst ourselves all the time. It's not done in isolation. Mm-hmm. Every new semester with a new mix of faculty is another opportunity to sort of work out the edges in the way we think about it. And in that new perspective always brings in improvements. We actually write exams the same way. You know, the group of instructors really gang writes the exams, but then we do something that I don't think anybody else does. We go ahead and share the draft of that with all the other professors who are usually teach 210. Mm-hmm. And everybody just has a free rein on, oh, I like this one. Oh, this one could change this way. Yeah, I just didn't even get that question, yeah. You know, and give back. And it's like editors to something that you've written. All you do is say, thank you. Right? Yeah. That was really awesome. Thank you for taking the time for reading something I've read. And believe me, when it comes back around, I will do you the same favor. So it always happens. It's really, I think that one could track, if one could track, it's impossible to do because the lectures are lost, right? But if one could track it, you would actually see fairly substantial evolution in the way that we think about teaching in a class. It really, really does. And it doesn't change. Some things don't change because we feel like we've kind of got it worked out. Some things do change, and then in response to things changing, the things that we didn't think were going to change might change correspondingly and so forth.
How important is student feedback in all of this?
Pretty important. You know, student feedback comes in, the most important part of student feedback. Let me tell you the least part of student feedback, okay? The least part of student feedback, I'm sorry to say, is the end of the term stuff. Well, the term's over, right? That's like a really crappy time to get feedback.
Yeah, no one's really... You're either really happy or you're really upset.
Right,
yeah.
Or whatever. Yeah. The best feedback is right there in class. Right? The best feedback is being open enough to the sensibility of the group of people in the room or at the Monday evening sessions or whatever it happens to be. So when you say something, you realize, that's not really going anywhere. I need to turn around. And so I do that all the time. And the semesters I've done two identical sections of 210, for example, they're never identical, because every different group of students has the same thing.
No, but I think the semester I took, there was an 8 a.m. lecture and a 3 yeah. p.m. There's very different students who are taking the 8 a.m. and the 3 p.m.
And if one were to look at those lectures and see that they were different, which they were, that is 100% related to student feedback. It's the student feedback that matters. You know, it's the nod, it's the smile, it's you right now acknowledging that you're understanding what I'm saying, right? Tells me to go in that direction or slow down or take another kind of pathway. So I would say yes.
Yeah. So my next question that I'd like to hear more about you personally is like what was your first teaching experience like? Like, how did you know this is for me? I just need my career just has to be.
Yeah, I have a horrible answer to that question because it's so unbelievable. You know, it really, really goes back deep into elementary school. I got to tell you, it goes back to first grade. It's really, you know, if you take into account what people say, okay, so something people say, and I really believe the brain scientists, things that you remember were coded because of very strong emotional responses. Trauma, joy, you know, that kind of sadness, whatever. So if I tell you I can remember three things from first grade, they're probably important.
Yeah.
Because everything else has been forgotten, but these are the three things that are keyed in. So I'll tell you the three things, right? Thing number one, first day of first grade. I can take that classroom and tell you where I'm sitting. And the reason I remember it was because of trauma. Because all the parents were lined up against the wall, and there they go walking out. Ah, that's horrible, right? Second day, also trauma. I was still crying on the second day. But it's because I wanted to stay.
Really?
My parents had to come get me and drag me out of school.
Why? Do you remember why?
I just thought, you know, I'm one of the oldest kids in my generation. I grew up around adults. I grew up really learning, you know, quickly and early, I think. And I think, wow, for whatever it is, you know, 6 hours a day, 7 hours a day, I can be doing this thing that I really like. That has to be what it is, right? I had to be having a good time. So the third thing was actually sitting on our sitting on the living room floor with my mom and dad telling them about earth science, holding an orange and a flashlight and daylight, sunlight, phases of the moon, all that kind of stuff. I remember that. I remember
you were teaching your parents.
I was teaching my parents, right? They were being nice parents. Yeah. What you learn in school today, all this kind of stuff. But what I remember is the sort of joy that came from explaining that science stuff to them. I wasn't talking to them about the alphabet. I wasn't talking to them about whatever the hell we were reading and so forth. It was actually the science stuff that I was motivated by. So that was always true, right? So I always find myself fairly motivated by science. Why? You know, I think I say this at the first day of 210 all the time. I think that science is a bit like having access to this whole secrets of the universe thing. I really like knowing that stuff, you know, and I really like telling those stories to people who go, oh, that's really interesting. I didn't know that. And I had a great fifth grade teacher and great middle school teachers and so forth. But I went into upper elementary school interested in science because of the experience that I had. It was really locked in place by sixth grade. And so that's half of the story. The other half of the story is about teaching, which I always did. I think it was in fifth grade I saw taken recess.
Really?
So I could stay inside and tutor and help peers and stuff like that. I was just that kid. So that's what I did all through middle school and high school and stuff like that. I just spent my empty periods in classrooms at the board working with people.
So how much do you love teaching? Like
whatever the top end of any scale is. It doesn't matter what I would have done in terms of subject, right? If I had been in art, if I had gone into art, or if I had gone into history, or if I had gone into car sales, I would be teaching it. I don't think there's any question I would be teaching it.
So would you consider yourself, do you run research studies now? But do you consider yourself a scientist first, teacher first, blend? I don't think it's something you have to make a distinction.
I don't think there's a distinction. And I don't think most people do, actually. Yeah. I think there's kind of a stereotype of that. But if you are a scientist in academia, you're always teaching. It's not just in class. It's your students in the laboratory, the doctoral students, the postdoctoral associates, whoever they are. The reason they are with you and the reason we have these offices and these groups and these laboratories is all about the education mission. There are people who do research for a living, and they work with fully trained scientists and who get paid big salaries at companies like Dow and DuPont and Lilly and so forth. Laboratories at the University of Michigan use research for an educational purpose. It's called graduate school for a reason.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing that characterizes the people who become professors and especially become good professors. They really see everything they're involved in as an educational mission. I see no separation.
This, I don't know, for some reason this sparked a memory back to Kev 210. I really had to have been the first day, that's funny. You said you need to be a master of the, like once you feel like you've mastered it, you can, once you feel like you're comfortable teaching it to everyone else.
Yep.
I know that.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. Nice. It's just I think that's true, right? At some point along the way, how do you know something? There's lots of ways to test it. You can do it, you can this, you can that. But if you can effectively teach it to someone, you know it.
I mean, I can only imagine how it feels. I've thought about teaching as well. Not that I've had much experience doing it, but I can only imagine what it's like to hear a student come to you and say, I learned so much, thank you so much for this.
Yeah, it's, that never gets old. You know, it never gets old, and it never gets old. You don't live for it. You don't have to get it, but I gotta tell you, when you get it, it never gets old.
Yeah.
And when it comes sometimes 10 years later and 20 years later and so forth, that's really very satisfying, and I've gone out of my way to make sure that I've let the people who influence me know that too, right? Really, you know, this kind of, I mean, there's one really great case, it's too long to tell, but I was with some friends of mine in California, and the person hadn't met me, And she was like, okay, why chemistry? Why science? Why this? Why that? And I've often told this story and tell you about the fifth grade teacher and her influence. Sixth grade teacher, her influence, her classroom, and so forth. And the woman was only there for half a year. Her last name was Smith. And she moved away. And I was in, you know, sixth grade. And the person who never met me before challenged me. She didn't really challenge me. She asked me a question. She said, so have you ever told her? I was like,
about the influence.
This is like, yeah. This is 2010. She's asking me this question. I was like, this is 1967. Her name is Smith. I don't even know her first name. I'm not actually sure if it was Mrs. Smith or Miss Smith. And she left. How am I supposed to do that, you know? And my dear friend who was there said, well, Brian, sounds like your kind of challenge. I was like, wow, screw you, you know? Sure enough, 6 weeks later, I found her.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, and I got to tell her. It was great. We've corresponded ever since. I was lucky. She was findable. There was stuff on the web, this kind of business. It took a little work, but I found her, and I had a chance to tell her, and it was really sad. I mean, it's also satisfying from the other end.
Right?
Well, I got a chance to tell her that, and she gets to look at, of course, then she starts to stalk me and sees the things I've done and all this kind of stuff, and she'd had a great career herself. She didn't actually stay in elementary education. It was the only 6 months. The only six months she'd never been in elementary education. I happened to have her for science. And she had this really profound effect. And so she was very happy to hear that.
That's so cool.
Yeah. It's really fun.
I don't want to keep you for much longer. I just have to say your office is so cool.
Thanks. I go to these places and bring stuff back.
Yeah.
I spend time here, so I surround myself with the things I like to look at.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen offices that are just like, nothing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
No, this is great. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yes. My pleasure.
I'd like to thank Professor Coppola again for letting me have the chance to sit down with him. It was truly inspiring to me, honestly. And honestly, you all should go check out his office. It's super cool. He has stuff from all over the world. Anyways, if you stayed and listened till right now, the end, thank you so, so much. This is my first time, and I doing some podcasts like this, and I really appreciate it. And just please let me know what you think. And also, if you know anyone, a professor, a student at the university, really anyone who would make for a great interview, is super cool, does awesome things for the world, the community, whatever, please contact me. You can email me at dewolf@umich.edu. That's dewolfe@umich.edu. Or if you're inclined, you can follow me on Twitter at Derek W 518. Thank you for listening.